Have you had a look around your grounds, around your lawn yet this spring? Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us today. I took a little look around, and I've got some plants that are coming up already, as a matter of fact. Some tulips are showing up, and some daffodils as well. So the flower season is upon us. Jeff Epping, director of horticulture at Olbrich Botanical Gardens, knows all about that. He is with us today to talk about your garden, talk about your flowers and your shrubs, and also to talk about the spring flower show that is held at the Olbrich Botanical Gardens, a fabulous show every year. And so we'll talk with him about it. He will answer your questions about flowers. We can talk about spring cleanup. We can talk about pruning, maybe even designing. How do you design a flower bed, perhaps? That's another thing we might take up with him. And, of course, you want to hear your comments and your own experiences as well. Call in at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Love to hear from you. And Jeff Epping, welcome back. Good to have you back.
Well, thanks for having me, Larry. It's always good to be here.
It's always wonderful to have you here. And, you know, this time of the year, not quite flowers out yet, but the spring flower show at Olbrich Garden is there.
Oh, absolutely. This warm weather is crazy. You know, every year it's something a little different in spring. But all this warm weather is getting people excited about spring. And we have a few bulbs coming up in the garden.
Yeah.
But but in the show, it's a full-blown outdoor spring garden and then some. So if you're starving for a little color, come on over and see us.
Yeah, the show runs until March 20.
Right, so we
still got some time yet. Yeah.
You bet. And you know, the overall theme of the show, I mean, it's always about the plants, of course, being a botanic garden, but we have fine furniture that is displayed amongst the series of rooms and patios, and hopefully we'll have some pictures up on the Facebook page to take a look at. But I want you to come out and see it instead, of course. But this furniture is absolutely incredible. It's every piece is a work of art. They're all Wisconsin artists, and Aaron Wilkie, our creator of the show, was responsible for assembling this great group of craftsmen. So there's everything from tables and chairs,
writing desks.
Oh yeah, and it goes on
stools.
And on. Wardrobes, hand turned bowls, rolling pins are part of it. Madison Lighting donated all the lighting fixtures for the show. It goes on. You have to see it and to really appreciate the quality and the time that must go into some of this furniture is just
unbelievable.
Blows my mind.
Yeah. And now will there be opportunity to purchase?
Yeah, a good many of the pieces are for sale.
Mm-hmm.
I know, I'm pretty sure most of them do custom work. So if you saw something that you like, they could probably make another one or two if it were something that you needed multiples of. There's a handful of pieces that aren't for sale, but most of them are, and all the information you need to contact them is there at the show.
And, of course, there's some flowers.
Oh, yeah, lots of flowers.
Couple.
Everything from daffodils and tulips, like, you know, we'll be seeing outside soon, to flowering shrubs like forsythia and, everything in between, lobelias, lilies. So it's, the great thing about the show is when you walk in, the fragrance just hits you. As soon as you walk in, it smells like spring. And that's always a good thing this time of year.
I'll be seeing you over there tomorrow.
Perfect.
Oh, that's one of the advantages of where I live. I live fairly close to the Olbrich Botanical Garden, so it's always a fun time to go and visit there. And there's all kinds of other things, of course, that we can talk about relating to the garden. But let's talk a little bit about what we should be doing in our own homes. I'm, looking at my beds, and I'm thinking, probably ought to clean up. Can't be too far.
No, we're doing that now. We're still doing a little pruning, but this warm weather is forcing all the bulbs into bloom, so we want to make sure that we sort of clean up around them so you can see them amongst all the old debris from last year. And we're big believers and saving a lot of the perennials through the winter because they had a lot of nice winter interest. But this time of year, they're looking a little worn and ragged. And so we're going around cleaning up. And, you know, what we're doing this year is we're trying to save all the debris on site and mow it right up on site and put it right back in the beds. And rather than what we typically have done in the past, hauling all that away to the compost pile and then bringing back some shredded leaves and that sort of thing, we're trying to keep it all in the garden and do it a little more environmentally friendly, a little less energy spent on all mm-hmm. that cutting, hauling, all those things. So that's the sort of thing we're doing right now, and yeah, it's coming along. Yeah, you know, it's a big garden, so we're all scrambling a bit, and volunteers will.
Well, how many acres have you got? I mean, you got.
We're about 16 acres, but, you know, we pack
enormous.
It in. We pack
oh,
it in.
Oh, yeah, man. Yeah, yeah. It is unbelievable. Did you ever count how many flowers?
I don't even want to know because it would just overwhelm me. No, I'm just kidding.
I mean, it's
no, we
thousands.
Actually do. We have thousands. A database. We're considered a living museum, so we keep track of where the plants come from, when they're planted. All what you would do if you were had a say a painting in a museum. We keep track of all those things and when it's pruned and inputs that go into it, so that we have good knowledge of that for our visitors and when we. Have inquiries from guests or other botanic gardens or such. We know where everything comes from, where how it's doing, and it's off the top of my head. I can't tell you where. It's always changing.
It's in the many thousands.
Oh yeah,
for sure.
Yeah, you bet.
Oh well. Julian Lamson has something for us here, so we can go there. I think. Hi, Julie. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I'm not sure if this would be any of the questions you can answer, but the snow has all disappeared up in the Northwoods here, and I'm seeing in various lawns kind of a white webbing, possibly a snow mold. Are you familiar with that? And
a little bit. I'm not a turf expert by any means, but sounds like something like snow mold. And typically, that happens when there's snow cover for a length of time and not good aeration, and so you might get a little of that happening. We see it at the garden from time to time. To be honest with you, we don't treat it with anything. We just get a rake out. Rake it up good, get that turf loosened up, get some air going through it, and it seems to always rebound without a problem. If it looks more serious than that and it's a big dead patch, then probably might just need to reseed or resod that space.
Yeah, but typically you're not going to have much problem.
No, I've never seen, for us, we've never had it kill the grass. It's just a little unsightly for a time, and then grass bounces right back.
You should be fine, Julie.
Do I have time for another quick question, sir?
Sure.
We don't have real good luck with all of the new coneflowers up here. Are there certain ones that you have found to be more hardy than the others? There's always so many cool ones, but they just don't seem to be real hardy.
Yeah.
There are so many new varieties out there, and I totally agree with you. So many of them are short-lived, and in that breeding work, they often use coneflowers or echinacea we're talking about from southern climates in the breeding work, and so some are hardier than others. A couple that have been hardy for us are out of the Midwest breeding programs. One is called Pixie Meadow Bright. That's been a good purple coneflower for us.
Pixie Meadow Bright.
Yeah. Kim's Knee High is another one. That's actually bred out of a program farther south, but has done very well for us. And then, just absolutely, the straight species, Echinacea purpurea, we try to buy from local sources. A lot of the sort of ecological restoration growers, the ones that grow for prairies and restoration stuff, often have seed that is collected locally, so you're getting genotypes that are better adapted to our situation. And then another species that's a true prairie coneflower, which I found to be much longer lived, is Echinacea simulata or pallida. Echinacea pallida is a pale purple coneflower. So it has like reflex petals.
Oh.
More like a shuttlecock or a badminton birdie.
Sort of look
to it. And I think they're absolutely gorgeous, and they stand about 3 feet tall. We're using those in our gravel gardens. They're super drought tolerant.
And what was that one again? Because people are going to say, well, wait a minute, what was
the
that?
Pale purple coneflower is Echinacea pallida, P-A-L-L-I-D-A. And then a very close related species is Simulata, S-I-M-U-L-A-T-A. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And those are, so those aren't the super fancy types in orange and yellow that, you know, that are out there and double flowered. But if you really want a sturdy coneflower for, you know, the pollinators and butterflies and the birds in the fall eat the seeds, those are ones that you'll have around for a while and will do well for you.
Yep. There we go. Thanks, Julie.
Thank you.
Yeah, appreciate the call. Tim in Dewey Township up next. Hi, Tim.
Hi. How you doing? I love the show, man.
Thank you.
You were talking last week. I was listening to you. You were talking about kind of homemade fertilizers and things for your garden.
Yeah.
What I do is I take a couple of 5 gallon buckets with lids, and I fill them about a third full with loose in comfrey leaves, fill them with water, fill a bunch of water, cover them up, give them a shake every day or when I walk by them. And after about a week or so, you open up the lid, boy, it really smells real bad. I'll tell you, but I, you know, kind of strained out, put in a sprinkling can, poured over my flowers, and I'll tell you what, they go nuts. No, I'm telling you, but I just wanted to see if you had a comment or if you have any experience using making comfrey tea. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, I can't say I have. I can tell you what we're using as far as compost is a compost tea that is made by someone local here. We use that on all of our turf now. We don't use any synthetic fertilizers on our lawns. We don't have a lot of lawn in Olbrich, but we have to have a little for our big parties and such that we have. And so, we're strictly on a compost tea program, and we have found that it is as good, if not better, than when we use the synthetic fertilizers. And one sort of bonus is that white clover really, for whatever reason, loves to grow in that with the compost teas. And so we have that throughout our turf. And now if you're a purist and you're going to be golfing on it, then you might not want white clover, but we like it for the fact that it blooms. It's beautiful. The bees are all over it when it's coming
up. It fixes nitrogen.
And it fixes nitrogen. So it's adding more nitrogen into the whole system. And then after it blooms, it just kind of blends in with the grass and never even know it's there. And so, you know, we're not purists. We don't need a golf course fairway or green as turf. And we like to, you know, like to pride ourselves in the fact that we're, you know, not throwing a lot of chemicals at it. So if you can keep it healthy, culture, you know, good culture, it keeps the weeds out and you don't have to deal with those.
Yeah, either. There we go. Tim, thanks a lot for sharing that. Appreciate it very much. You can join in too, by the way. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. Taking a look at flowers and shrubs today. The Olbrich Gardens Spring Flower Show. All kinds of good stuff here on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Happy to have you along today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here. Just to mention, next time on Garden Talk, we'll be talking about fruit trees and hazelnuts and high tunnels. So that's next week for Garden Talk. Right now, we're taking a look at your flowers in your spring garden with Jeff Epping, director of Olbrich Botanical Gardens in Madison. He comes by every so often to talk with us. Always a lot of fun. And I hope you'll join in. Any questions or comments or experiences to share? Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Lisa was wondering about she has an oak stump, and you guys must get this over at the garden too once in a while. You get a tree that dies, and but then it sort of you get regrowth.
Right, right. Basically, what happens? The root system's still alive, even though we've cut the top down. So of course, the tree wants to grow again. And so typically we will just, two things you can do. If you hire somebody to grind the stump, if it's, you know, rather large and you want to just sort of get rid of it, that generally takes care of it, but it's going to cost you a little money. Otherwise, just, you know, as it resprouts, we just kind of keep cutting those sprouts off until it exhausts itself and then it's gone. A little trick, too, is if you have a tree and you know you're going to want to get rid of it in a year or two or... the year prior, maybe even 2 years prior, we can do is girdle the tree. Take off that live cambial layer, the outer bark on the tree. And I actually did this at home because I planted some trembling aspen, which I love.
Yeah.
But they're really starting to sucker everywhere. And it's time, I thought, I got other trees now that are slower growing that have taken, I want to take the space. So
sure.
I girdled it and girdled it last season. And what it'll do is it will literally... starve the tree, the root system will die, then the rest of the tree dies. And then when you cut it down, you don't have any of that. You don't have any of that resprouting. And it's not as necessary, say an oak or something, but if you have a tree that's a suckering tree, that's something that you want to do. Otherwise, as soon as you cut it, it's going to be shooting up everywhere, and you'll be fighting it for a while until you sort of exhaust the root system.
Very good tip. Virgin Sturgeon Bay has something for us. Hi, Virg. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Larry. Thank you. Good show. So I'm doing a moon garden. I've got raised beds. And in these beds, I have, in one bed, I have two apple trees, and one, I have two pear trees. And what I'm asking for is some advice on white flowers that would have about the same pH needs as the apple and pear. I have another set of raised beds that have plums in them, and I'm doing white roses there because they have the same pH. But any advice?
What is a moon garden, by the way?
It's all white flowers, so at
night,
it, so it kind of glows. It's really pretty.
Really?
So, this is all full sun, then?
Yes.
Okay.
So, and I'm in Door County.
Okay, so you have lots of possibilities, right? I mean, there's, as far as the pH goes, I mean, most of the perennials are very adaptable, so I don't think that's really going to be a limiting factor for you. So, you know, any of the full sun perennials. So I'm a big fan of geraniums. And we're talking about not the pelargonium, not the annual geranium, but the true perennial geranium.
What's geranium?
Geranium maculatum. I think the flower factory locally, a nursery here, has probably 50, if not more, taxa of geraniums. But anyway, they're usually about anywhere from 6 inches up to 2 feet tall. Fantastic plants. There's some white flowered forms. One is just album, geranium maculatum album, or sanguineum album, I should say. The common name for that group is really crane's bill. But the genus, the real scientific name, is actually geranium. So that's actually a true geranium. The other ones are all annuals, pelargoniums and such. Anyway, that's just one. We have a little bit of a white garden within the courtyard of our rose garden. And as far as annuals go, we like to use some of the annual salvias, Salvia farinacea, if you're familiar with that, as sort of a spiky flower. There's a white cultivar called Argentea. Also, the flowering tobaccos are awesome
because
of the fragrance.
Oh, man, they're great.
Yeah, and a lot of those are white. There's white forms of coneflower, which we talked about with one of our last guests here. I think you have a wide palette that you can use.
Okay, so it doesn't really matter what I put next to these particular trees then?
I don't think so, no. I mean, the pH isn't going to be, it shouldn't be an issue at all.
Okay, cool. Very good.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot for calling. The tobacco, boy, there's some of those, right? Oh, yeah. Just the aromas.
Exactly. I give some tours at Olbrich, you know, in the evening. And typically the fragrance is greater in the evening because the wind is down and it sticks around. And, you know, you pick it up and it's like, what? And then, of course, it's like, oh, yeah, we have fine tobacco just around the bend. And sure enough, when you turn the corner, it's just
there. It is.
Yeah, it's fantastic.
Bob and Elkhorn. Up next. Hi, Bob.
How you doing? Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I got a question. I have a dwarf apple tree, and I had it wrapped with one of them spiral wraps.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
But a rabbit chewed through the spiral wrap and knocked it down and ate a path all the way around my little apple tree about 6 inches high. Is that tree going to die? Should I be ordering a new replacement for it? Or
More than likely. Yeah. Once it gets that far around. I mean, if it were maybe a quarter, I'd say you're probably okay. Half is even questionable. But if it went all the way around, yeah, I think you're better off just ordering one up now while you still can.
Okay, that's what I wanted to know.
Sorry
all right,
that.
Thanks, Bob. Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Yep, do it now. Robin Dubuque, Iowa. Hello, thank you for calling.
Hi there. Thank you for taking the call.
Sure.
I have a... Oh, it's a, started out as a handrail. Now it's kind of a long trellis. And it's set up to where it accepts these probably 24-inch long planter boxes. They're about 6 inches wide, 6 inches deep. And what we're attempting is to grow some vining things that create some privacy.
Okay.
And we're in the past years I've been... planting some morning glory, some hyacinth bean, moon flowers, that type of thing. And I've been using just kind of a general purpose potting soil. Any suggestions on, after so many years, should I change that potting soil out? Am I better off using, a garden soil? And... Yeah.
Sure.
It gets quite a bit of sun. Watering, needs to be real frequent, I guess. I don't have a lot of room for roof,
Right. Yeah. Right. Yeah. I mean, a good potting soil has a good amount of organic matter and good drainage in it. And so typically the more you spend on a potting soil, the better it is.
Yeah.
To be honest with you, if you go to a good garden center, you'll find higher quality potting soils. If you go to sort of a big box store, they're cheaper, but they're not nearly as good because they don't have pine bark and some of the perlite and vermiculite, these things that sort of keep it nice and light and airy. I never recommend digging out of your own garden and putting it in a pot because it quickly loses the porosity or the aeration. And after about 2 months, it comes the consistency of concrete. And if you've ever watered a pot like that and the water sits in it for about an hour before it actually, finally gets in, that's not a good potting soil. So I think, at home, I reuse my potting mix 2-3 seasons.
Yeah.
Typically what I do in the fall is I empty all my pots, put them in black plastic garbage bags or containers, whatever I have. And then in the spring, I dump them all out on my garage floor. I might mix a couple new bags into it to loosen, get some new stuff in and reuse it. And unless you have had real issues with disease, I think you're fine. And at the point where the potting soil has become exhausted, where it's very broken down, then I add it to my compost pile or work it into my garden or whatever, because it's great organic matter. And,
absolutely.
Might as well recycle that and reuse it.
Yep. There you go, Rob. Right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, appreciate the call. And Daniel in Manawa, we turn to you next. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hey, Larry, I've got 100 questions for you.
Okay, well, let's go. Number one.
Okay, number one is I want to put some prairie seed down this year.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a rather large area. When do I do that?
Well, that's, you know, a lot of times the prairie, the seeds need what's called a vernalization. And typically you would plant them in the fall, and then they would through the winter months and get the cold, moist treatment that breaks the dormancy of some of the seeds. However, you may be able to buy vernalized seed. I would call, you know, your nearest prairie nursery. Where's Manawa? I should know that, but I don't.
Waupaca County.
Prairie Nursery is in Westfield, which isn't too far from you guys, and they're experts in prairie restoration. There's others out there, but
okay. They what was that closest. Again? Prairie Nursery
in Westfield, Wisconsin.
Okay.
And they are absolute experts on the subject, so I would suggest that you give them a call and see what they think. At this time of year, I mean, if we're a smaller prairie, plugging it is probably the quickest and
some things you should probably be doing to that area before, you know, depending on what's in there now.
Right.
There may be, Neil DeBole is the head of Prairie Nursery, and he may be recommending some things you do prior to even setting plants. So
right. Yeah, he might suggest you just leave that ground fallow for the season, or
cover
till
it, or
till it or something to get the weed seeds to germinate and down, and then go ahead and do the seeding this fall. But yeah, they're experts in the field, and I know he's been on this show more than once.
Neil's been on.
Neil's a great guy. So that would be my suggestion.
Yep. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. He actually goes, I mean, he goes around the world. He's doing advising in Europe and all over the place.
Yeah, he knows his stuff.
But he sounds like the guy next door. That's the nice thing about
him. He could be a stand-up comedian. That's the greatest thing about going to one of his lectures.
Dean in Mount Horeb up next. Hi, Dean. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Got a question. I have an old apple tree. It's been on our land probably since we bought the place over 20 years ago. And over the years, it's bloomed. But particularly over the last 5 years or so, it seems like a branch here and a branch there is dying out and is blooming. You know, less and less of the tree is blooming. So my question is, they're not high quality apples. We usually just feed them to the horses or something. But should I cut off the dead branches, or does it make a difference? Is it a symptom that basically every year another branch is going to die off and eventually it's going to be totally dead?
More than that. I mean, the tree sounds like it's in decline. I mean, no tree lives forever. And if you really want to have a tree that produces high quality apples, I would definitely plant others. Right. I think you can find much more disease-resistant apples out there now on dwarfing rootstocks, which will do two things. It'll make the tree smaller in stature, so it'll be easier to maintain, and it also makes the tree produce fruit sooner when they're grafted on a dwarfing rootstock, so they're more precocious, as they say. So, you know, I planted some apples at my own home, espaliered against the south side of my house, and I selected Honeycrisp because they're my absolute favorite.
Yeah.
And but you know, an old apple tree has a beautiful character to it in the landscape. If it's part of, you know, if you like the look of it, and keep that one around and plant some others, and you can have your cake and eat it too, so to speak.
Yeah, but you can get rid of those dead, cut them right off at the bases.
Yeah, if you're pruning that, then there's a. Well, I have a pruning class coming up at Oldbrook. If you want to sign up, go check our website out. But you just remove all that dead wood. That would help spread any disease.
There we go. Good luck. Thanks a lot. So what's your pruning class? Well, I was going to say, what's it about? You're going to say it's about pruning.
Typically, it's about a three-hour class. I don't have the date off the top of my head. So like I say, there's a whole list of fantastic classes at Oldbrick. So hit our website and list them all. But mine is typically on a Saturday, 3 hours long. We spend an hour inside and then 2 hours outside and show people the real deal. You know, you can show slides, but it's not the same.
Not the same.
Out in the field. So it's very popular. Oftentimes I've done two in the spring and they always fill up. So,
there you go. And just go online to Oldbrick Gardens. We have a link on our
org. Yeah,
Oldbrick.org. Oldbrick.org, is it?
Yep. www.olbrich.org.
Yep, easy one to find. We have it up on our Facebook page too at the Larry Mueller Show. If you happen to be there, just click on it and it'll take you right there. Jeff in Brookfield up next with something for us. Hi, Jeff. Thanks for calling.
Thank you. I planted several rose campion last year, and they grew to a very nice size. Now, I did not cut them back at all last year. Is there anything I should do to them before the season really starts, or just leave them be, and will they keep
typically you just cut off the dead growth, you know, near the base of the plant, and they should come back for you. Rose campion is a really beautiful perennial, not one that's typically long-lived, but sometimes they do self-seed, and it's a perennial that likes good drainage. So one that you wouldn't want to over-mulch. And if you lose them in a wet, open winter, that wouldn't be unusual. Just plant another and maybe, you know, think about spots in your garden that get good full sun, which it likes, and good drainage.
But any leaves that are still green, just leave them alone?
If there's a little green foliage at the base, sure. Why not just leave it? It'll help it rebound. And then if they look a little ratty later as the new growth comes out, you can always snip them off. Or typically the new growth just covers up the old and they're good to go. Of course, you know, perennials in nature, nobody cuts them back. Nobody does anything to them, right? And they're perfectly fine. So you wouldn't have to do anything. But, of course, being gardeners, we like them to look as nice as possible. So we do a little extra, right?
Well, thank you, and I love your gardens.
Oh, thank you.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. And we finally have open lines again. We can get you on pretty quickly. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. And, of course, you can always email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page. Hey, if you've got a nice flower garden photo, love to see that on the Facebook page. Facebook page title, of course, The Larry Mueller Show. So we'd love to hear from you. Eric in Thiensville, here's a kind of a different question. And you guys probably use chippers over at Olbrich. He wonders if you have a recommendation for a chipper that works well with smaller branches. He says the ones he's found, they're either too powerful or they're not powerful enough.
All right. Well, I'll be honest with you. We don't use a chipper over at Olbrich.
Oh.
We compost all the, you know, the softer material.
Of course, yeah.
But the brush is picked up by the City of Madison Forestry, and they have a ginormous tub grinder where they process all the wood. And then, you know, it's reused in parks for mulch and those sort of things, make it available to the public to pick up. So I'm sorry, I can't tell you. It is hard because the powerful ones will do the job, but they're also, you know, loud and big and expensive and probably not worth, you know, a homeowner purchasing. But then again, a lot of the smaller ones really aren't that powerful enough, as he states.
Yeah, it's one of those things where, you know, if you've been in a neighborhood a long time and your neighbors have two, maybe four or five people go together and get one.
Well, that's good. Yeah, it's a good point. I mean, my wife and I, we have a wood stove at home, and I like to, you know, to get all my own wood and split it. And so we have some friends who do the same. So we went in on a log splitter because it's one of those things you use a few times.
Yeah.
And then it sits there. So it's
handy as the devil, but kind of a little expensive just to have for yourself.
Exactly.
Yep.
Exactly.
Patrick in Fort Atkinson, your turn. Hi, Patrick.
Hi there. I'm calling. I got some privacy conifers growing alongside my garage and my driveway. And I was wondering how I could remove them. They're all different heights and all different kinds. And I don't want to destroy the land because I'd like to plant something along there, but I don't know how to go about removing them.
How big of trees are they? I mean, like a caliper size, you know, the
they're about 10 feet tall and just about 5 to 7 feet wide.
Okay. So the trunks on them are going to be 2-inch caliper, 3, 4?
The trunks are going to be about 4 inches in diameter.
Okay. So it's pretty sizable. Me being a lazy gardener, I would just cut them off at the base. Not many conifers resprout.
No.
Very, very few. So I would just cut them down close to the soil level and plant in between them. Now, when you plant, you're probably going to be digging through some roots, but it's a lot easier to dig through a few roots for a planting hole than it is to grub all those trees out of there, which will be a,
okay.
be a huge
real
amount
mess.
Of work.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And what would you do about the stump?
Just leave
They're
them in place.
They're pretty close together.
They'll just, oh, you can't plant in between them?
Well, you could, but I would be worried about the roots suffocating whatever you plant.
Yeah, those roots will just they will decompose and add to the sort of the organic matter of the soil. Probably it'll take a few years, but I wouldn't worry too much about it. At the garden, we rarely grub out big trees. We just cut them off and let them rot and plant, you know, around them, and all's good.
So. That's what I do.
Yeah.
Okay. That's the easy way out.
Otherwise, you hire some with a bobcat, and they grub about with a big machine. But that's expensive, and like you say, it causes a lot of havoc, and then you have to repair.
Then you can kind of mulch. Over. You can cover those stumps if you want.
Oh yeah,
you know, there's ways to do it to
you
make
bet.
It look nice.
You bet.
So good luck, Patrick. Thank you very much for calling, David in Appleton. It's your turn. Hi, David.
Good morning.
Morning.
I have a question. We have three, and please correct me, clematis?
Yep, sure.
Either way.
We have three of them. One has spectacular blooms. Each of the plants are very robust growers, and, you know, they leaf out. One has spectacular blooms. The second one, you know, you get a handful, and the third one, zip. And I'm wondering if there's something we can do to encourage the two laggard plants to show off a little bit more.
And they were purchased at the same time, and they get about the same amount of sun. And
the one very hardy bloomer, and the one that's a little rather less so, those we bought at the same time. They're within, you know, 4 or 5 feet of one another. The other one is in a different location. We purchased that at a different time. That one actually gets the most sun.
Hmm. Okay. And are they all the same varieties or cultivars? Are they all different? Do you have any idea? I mean, from the
plants? I'm imagining the two that are close to one another are, I would say those are the same. And the other, honestly, I don't know the answer.
Okay. And you don't have the names of any of them, I assume.
No, I'm
okay.
sorry.
Okay. Well, clematis in general, or clematis, however you say it, typically like full sun, but they like cool roots. So they like a cool root system, and that's where they're happiest. So how do you do that, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, the best way is to plant them on the north side of something that shades the root systems. You can plant them on the north side of a shrub or a fence, if you will, or something like that. And then mulch the root system so that they stay a little bit cooler. So that's the first thing they prefer. There are also spring blooming clematis as well as summer blooming clematis. And if you were to prune the spring bloomers hard, you'll prune off all the flower buds before they bloom. So if that one that's not blooming is a spring bloomer, that might be the case. Otherwise, it's you know, there's a lot of clematis that really are not hardy for us. It's possible that maybe the variety that was sold was really not one that we should be growing in the north. So, yes, it's root hardy, but it's not the top is keeps burning off, and you're not getting the flower buds to form. That's another possibility. Mm-hmm. They're not particularly fussy. They like rather alkaline soils, so they're often very good, at least for the southern and south central part of the state. Farther north, where it's a little more acid, it might be
not as well.
Yeah, you could lime them if you had a soil test and it was very acid or something. But typically, those would be the instances, I would think. You know, that would lead to the lack of blossoms on them.
Mm-hmm. There we go.
And there's a bunch of clematis out there. So, boy, just go out and buy some others. I prefer the more wild-type clematis, the small-flowered clematis. They seem to be the least fussy of the bunch. There's a disease called clematis wilt, which seems to be a little more prominent on these very hybridized cultivars with the ginormous flowers. The Chicago Botanic Garden did an evaluation a few years back, and if you look on the internet, look up plant evaluation notes. Richard Hawke, H-A-W-K-E, is the horticulturist at the Botanic Garden. He evaluates all sorts of different perennials and such for the Chicago region, which often is very similar to us. Go online and look that up, and he'll list all the top performers. But there's so many good ones out there, and grow fast.
There's no sense just to look at that one that's not flowering.
No, I wouldn't. I'd just say, heck with it. We'll get another one.
There we go, David. Thank you so much for calling. Visiting today with Jeff Epping, Director of Horticulture at Olbrich Botanical Gardens in Madison. I'm Larry Mueller. Jill Nadeau, our on-air producer today here on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks so much for being with us today on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest Jeff Epping of Olbrich Botanical Gardens in Madison, where he is the Director of Horticulture. So it's always fun to have him come by and talk about flowers and shrubs and spring cleanups and pruning and design, all kinds of things. Glenn in Wausau has a question, so we'll go there next. Glenn, hi. Thank you for calling.
Good morning, Larry and Jeff. Great show. I have a couple of questions in regard to blueberries. Mm-hmm. And I'll give you both questions and then I'll hang up. But the first one is, what should my yearly feeding be to these blueberry plants that are 3 to 8 years old? And the second question is, I'm always so paranoid to trim those bushes down, and I know I need to. I mean, some of them are 7, 8 years old, and I haven't done any trimming on them. So if you could give me some angles of that, I'd appreciate it.
Okay, well, as far as blueberries go, everybody is fairly aware that they need an acid soil. So one of the things that you have to do is to make sure that you acidify the soil, especially if you're in the southern part of the state where our soils are very alkaline. So there's products in
their
local gardens.
Isn't quite so bad.
Okay, yeah, not too bad. So an annual feeding of probably just a general purpose fertilizer would be good. If you give them too much nitrogen on any sort of fruiting or vegetable crop, you end up getting more growth and less flower, which means less fruit. Keep an eye on the plants, make sure the leaves are nice and green and healthy, and that's, probably all you need to do is that, sort of a slow-release fertilizer in the beginning of the season, or organic fertilizers, which kind of release nice and slow during the season as well. As far as pruning, I'll be honest, I'm not an expert on blueberries because, again, they like acid soil, so we don't grow a lot of them in this part of the state. But thinking about, just shrubs in general, what we're doing is often renewal pruning them, where we're taking out some of the oldest wood, about a quarter to a third of the oldest wood, which then encourages new growth from the crown or base of the plant. So then, in essence, you never have canes in that shrub that are more than 3 or 4 years old, mm-hmm. which keeps them nice and healthy. Nice, newer, vigorous growth all the time. And then with blueberries, I believe they bloom on at least 1 year old wood, so that new growth that comes up from what you cut off won't bear fruit that first year, but should in future years. So you always have a nice balance of young and older to keep the plant healthy but yet fruitful.
And Glenn, thanks again. Steve in Thiensville, you're up next. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, how are you all doing? I have a question regarding a spruce tree that fell over in my yard. It had been there for like 50 years. It was about 60 feet tall, left a big space for me to fill. Mm-hmm. What should I plant there, or what shouldn't I plant there? I mean, what's okay to plant and what might die from? I'm just wondering about the soil.
Mm-hmm. Well, it sounds like the tree just suffered Storm damage, so...
Storm damage. It blew over in the winds 3 weeks ago.
Okay, so it was no disease problems.
No disease, shallow roots, only about a foot deep.
Okay, sure. Well, it's, I think, you know, the sky's the limit, and depending on if you want another evergreen plant or another conifer, or you want something deciduous. I don't think I would worry about the fact that the tree... you know, blew over the roots. If there's roots in there, again, they're gonna decompose over time. And sure. any new tree, whether it be in a situation like that or planted out in an area that never had a plant of that sort in it, you know, that first 2 years, even 3 years, you really have to, you know, give the plant a little extra help to get the root system mm-hmm. established and going. The first season more so, second a little bit, third season during periods of drought, and you know, put a little mulch there to keep the competition from turf away, you know, sort of competing for nutrients and water, and get that tree off to a good start. And then after that, it's, you know, pretty easy.
Okay, so nothing with the soil would have been changed by the tree, didn't make it more acid or anything to work?
No, I wouldn't worry about that. No.
Okay, wasn't sure.
Sure. It's a good question. Absolutely.
Okay, and a follow-up on my neighbor in Thiensville that called earlier about the chipper. Mm-hmm. I've got a little lawn vacuum. Well, it's not too little. Sucks up leaves, and it has a port on the side for about inch to an inch and a half branches.
Wow.
So that's a nice option, because then it sucks up your leaves, bags them, and you can throw all the sticks in there.
Wow, wow, that sounds awesome.
Yeah. Okay.
All right. Where'd you get it?
It was a gift.
Oh, okay. Well, there you go. But it's at least something you can actually type that in or stop at your local garden center and describe it, and they're probably going to know what it is. And if they don't have one, they can order one.
Absolutely.
It's worth a look anyway, for sure. It sounds like it's working for Steve.
That's pretty big-sized wood.
Yeah.
An inch and a half.
Greg in Watertown up next. Hi, Greg.
Good morning, Larry and Jeff. Say, a quick side note, I just harvested some spring parsnips. The nettles are up, and the Egyptian bunching onions are harvestable right now in their early stage. But more importantly, I wanted to mention that Sustain Jefferson is holding its annual spring workshop, and this year our theme is the birds and the bees, and we'll be featuring Neil Diebold from Prairie Nursery, and he'll be talking about the how and why and when of prairie restoration. And as you mentioned earlier, there's nobody better to talk about prairie restoration than Neil.
Absolutely.
That's when is that event, Greg?
That is Saturday, April 2nd. It begins at 9 a.m., and it's being held at the Concord Community Center, which is near the intersection of I-94 and Highway F in Jefferson County.
Mm-hmm. Nice and easy to get to.
Yeah, absolutely. So, yeah. Again, April 2nd?
Yes, April 2nd. That's a Saturday. And it's a great event. A lot of nice people are there. We're going to have a wonderful lunch. We're also featuring the Dodge County Beekeeping Association, and they'll be helping folks get started in maintaining their bee operation. So the birds and the bees, there's nothing more important than that, right?
That's right.
You're absolutely right, Greg. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. And you'll definitely enjoy hearing Neil speak, that's for sure. Don in Eau Claire up next. Don, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Larry and Jeff. I'm 93 years old. I'm a lifelong gardener, but right now I'm handicapped and dependent on other people. But anyway, I have four bushes outside my kitchen window. They're, you call them flaming bush or fire bush or something.
Burning bush, maybe?
Yeah.
Euonymus,
Yes. Mm-hmm. And they were planted like 3 years ago. Last year we had beautiful growth on them. And at the end of the season, we trimmed back so it was just below the window level on from inside the house. Mm-hmm. And they were doing fine through the winter. But then it was called to my attention, and when I was outside in a wheelchair, I did see it. They've been nibbled on about a foot and a half above the ground, leaving about a foot up above. And we have deer foraging around here at night, also rabbits on loose.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's more likely deer. But anyway, my concern is that if they have to be trimmed back because of the gnawing on the things, how far can they be trimmed back and still come back?
Yeah, it's it's hard to say without seeing the shrub, but of course, burning bush is a favorite of rabbits, and they often nibble on the smaller branches, but they also can strip the bark and the cambium right off the trunk portion. So if the bark is completely gone or girdled around down to sort of white inner bark, you'll be able to tell pretty easily because it's very distinctive. If it's gone all the way around, you know, you really don't have a choice but to prune back just below that girdled portion, because everything beyond that's going to die anyway. So only prune them back as hard as you need to get rid of that, knot on pieces and,
if there's nothing below.
Yeah, I've seen burning bush prune back pretty darn hard, and they'll come back. But it's just a matter of, how healthy the plant was before, which it sounds like it was. Oftentimes, I recommend if people have shrubs that are vulnerable to rabbit damage, to cage them in the winter, and you usually have to go up about 3 feet or so around the whole outside of the plant. And if they, chew the tips, that's one thing. But when they get down low, then you're jeopardizing the life of the plant. A little late for that now, but try to just prune it back as minimally as you can, and keep your fingers crossed.
Hope for the best. Yeah,
good. That's all you can do.
Yeah, hope. Good luck, Don. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Alan and Racine wondered if the honeybee die-off is going to affect his flower garden, and we've been talking about that a little bit on the show. And there are a lot of other bees out there, and
there
pollinators.
Yeah, I was just at a lecture a couple weekends ago, and there was an expert on pollinators, and they said that in the state of Michigan there were over 400 different bees that are working away on flowers there, which I had no idea.
We have something like 300 to 400.
Is that right? See, so we all know that the honeybee really isn't a native pollinator, right? It's something that was introduced. So with that said, we have beehives at Olbrich, and I walked by them the other day, and they are buzzing big time. They are active already, and so there's a decline, but they're still out there, and we have all the others too.
So if you've got your flowers and your shrubs, are going to bring the bees and the other pollinators. Jeff Epping, our guest today, Director of Horticulture at Olbrich Botanical Gardens in Madison, for Garden Talk. So happy to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here, speaking of Olbrich Gardens. We have Jeff Epping, Director of Horticulture at Olbrich Botanical Gardens in Madison, talking flowers and shrubs and taking a look at the spring garden, the spring flower show, and I hope you'll join in with your own questions at 800-642-1234. Love to hear from you. And Jeff, we've got posted up. Brian Chesso posted some photos that you took at Olbrich, and the sale's on, of course, right now, and it goes till the 20th. And there's a lot of cool photos. I hope people go to our Facebook page to see those.
Yeah, you can see how all the plants are in containers for the most part, and really give you some nice ideas. And it's just so nice to be around.
Oh, that's the thing. Yeah, and it smells great.
Yeah, you can see all the beautiful furniture displayed. People have really enjoyed the show so far, and runs through next week too. So. After the show, then all the good majority of the plants that you see in the photos are go on sale, and most of them hold up pretty well. So they're cheap, and so we make a little money in the end to support the garden too.
That's wonderful. And as long as we're at it, we've got you've got your plant sale on March 21st. Then
for the show, the sale show. Yep,
and then then you got a pansy sale on April 2nd. And then a plant sale with the pros, which is a really cool event, May 6th and 7th.
Yeah, it's always Mother's Day weekend. It's the Friday and Saturday of that weekend. And it's special because we get a lot of professionals volunteering for the sale. So they are there to answer any and every question you might have about plants. We also have a design station where two landscape architects are stationed, and these are all architects from the area working for firms that donate their time, and you come in with pictures and diagrams, maybe even a little map of your garden. They help you, you know, just kind of figure some things out, and hopefully buy a few plants at the sale to, yeah, to make that happen. So it's all good. It's a great sale, and it's a great fundraiser for the garden.
Yeah, and again, go to obrick.org. O-R-G, or just go to our Facebook page and click on it, because we've got a link to it right there. We'll get you to it. Jan in Middleton has a question, so let's go to her. Hi, Jan.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is about pruning hydrangeas. Mm-hmm. I have a quickfire hydrangea that was inspired by some of them at Old Brick in my garden now.
Nice.
And I know it blooms on new wood and needs to be pruned. It seems like spring is coming really quickly now, and I'm wondering, is it too late to prune it this year, and how far back should I prune it?
No, not at all. It's the perfect time to prune. Quickfire hydrangea is what most people refer to as a PG hydrangea.
Mm-hmm.
So they love full sun. This isn't the smooth hydrangea, which we are familiar with. Annabelle, that one you can cut right to the ground. That blooms on new wood as well. But this type of hydrangea, the panicle hydrangea, we prune back hard. Again, you don't have to worry about removing flower buds because it'll form those. But basically, depending on how old the plant is, when it gets to about the size you want it to be, you can keep it at that size just about forever. And so we literally will prune off 4 to 5 feet of growth back to a pair of or nodes where the new growth will ensue, and it will regrow another 3 to 4 feet, bloom, and then we kind of prune it back the next year, maybe one node farther out from that. It's kind of hard to pruning is kind of hard to explain over the phone over the radio, but it's the perfect time to do it. And again, you're in Middleton, so there's no reason you can't come to my pruning class that's coming up soon.
Yeah, why not?
And I'm an Old Brick member, so
perfect.
I'm doing it.
Yeah. Okay. We'll see you there then, Jan.
Thank you. Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Oh, man. Ellen in Waupun has a question. Hi, Ellen.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I'm about ready to start some lettuce greens and spinach in the garden, and typically I would plant them in a row, but I think I've seen where people have made like a 2 square foot or more area and just scattered the seed in there. Does it make a difference, do you think, for the possibility of growth?
Well, I think oftentimes things are put in rows because they're sometimes easier to maintain in between, like with the weeding and that sort of thing. As far as doing it in more, there's like square foot gardening where you divide the space into a series of squares and plant each with something a little different. I think, you know, either way, of course, salad greens are typically, you know, growing during the cooler part of the spring. And then once the temperatures warm up, then the seed, you know, they bolt, as they say, and then they're kind of bitter. And so if you just sort of plant them here and there early, they're coming out anyway later when you're going to be putting your tomatoes and peppers in typically. But so, yeah, you can do it either way, but oftentimes they're in rows more for a practical standpoint than anything.
No reason you can't just kind of broadcast a little area and let them go that way.
Sure.
Good luck. Thanks for calling. Pat in Luxembourg would like to know about transplanting and propagating moss.
Hmm.
Do you have? Oh, she also uses lavender oil to keep rabbits from her bushes. She sprinkles it on the ground. Lavender oil.
Wow.
Huh. Haven't heard of that.
Awesome
too. Yeah,
smells
awesome.
Sounds a little expensive, but if it works. As far as propagating moss, that's nice to hear, because so often I hear people say, I have moss growing in my lawn, and how do I kill it? And typically moss is growing because it's in a shady, moist area where grass doesn't want to grow, right? So I always say, try to keep the moss and get rid of the grass. So in this instance, propagating moss, you know, at this time of year, you can just pull up areas that are already green, transplant them to bare soil in another area. You know who does a great job with mosses is Janesville Rotary Garden.
Oh, yes.
Mark Dwyer has a moss garden there right next to the Japanese garden. So if you want to see a real nice example of a moss garden, check that out. And there's mosses, there's ferns, you know, all those plants that love that shady situation. But there's also a good book on growing mosses, and the name escapes me right now, but I bet if you Google it, you'll find it on Amazon or somewhere else. But, you know, I've heard people where they actually take buttermilk and some moss, put it in a blender, grind it all up, and then paint that on, like, rock, north-facing rock faces or east-facing where it's nice and shady and cool, and another way to propagate them and get them to grow.
You know, on another occasion, and this is a while back, another time when you were here, we talked about gravel gardens. And that is... That's kind of a cool thing, and I think it'd be worth it to talk about them, what they are. And
absolutely. No, I'd love to.
You guys
to.
Are really
it's,
cool ones.
It's my passion these days, and, you know, we're trying to make gardening easier for everybody and trying to keep the environmental impact down, you know, keep down the watering, the chemical usage, that sort of thing. And these gravel gardens are a concept that came out of Germany, actually. A garden over there called Hermannshof, and they've experimented with these gravel gardens for over 20 years and kind of perfected the plants they use. Many of them are actually U.S. native plants that they're using, even in Germany. But basically, they're plants that love droughty conditions, so dry prairie plants, plants of mountainous regions that don't get a lot of moisture. And what we do is we create a system, if you will, to grow these plants in, and we take the parent soil that's there, and then we add to the top of that soil, typically level it out. It can be a little bit wavy, but not a big deal. Add about 4 to 5 inches of gravel. We use a quartzite gravel, which will not break down over time, like maybe a sandstone or limestone gravel. And these are... It's similar to pea gravel, if you will. It's an angular gravel, but the idea is it's sort of like marbles in a jar. You know, you can never pack them down. There's always airspace maintained in between the pieces of gravel. Well, what does that do? That gives you a very, I wouldn't say impenetrable, but really tough for a weed seed to land on that, send its little root down through all that gravel and root in. And because so what it's doing is it's acting as a mulch to cool the soil beneath and to create this weed barrier. And so once you have that gravel in place, then you you plant right through the gravel. And we use like 2.5 or 3.5 inch size pots, which are typically about 4 to 5 inches deep, the root ball. And we just kind of dig the gravel out of the way, put the root ball in there. It doesn't have to touch the soil below because obviously the roots will grow down. The main chore then in the first couple weeks is water. Because here you are, you're putting this this plant surrounded by gravel, so they got to get the roots down into the gravel or to the soil, I should say, below. Once they do, then they get a foothold, and after say the second season, they're pretty much on their own. If we had a really droughty season, we might give them a little sprinkle of water. But other than that, your main chore then, and which is we have a whole crew coming in next week because we have some extensive gravel gardens at Olbrich, brand new one out in front of the building. We'll come through and cut all those perennials off and take that away. And then we'll follow up with a light raking and even a blower to get all the debris out of the top of the gravel that's laying on the top, because what we want to prevent is any organic matter from building up, because the organic matter becomes sort of a kind of a seed germination medium,
area.
And that's what we don't want. But after that's done, Larry, we're done for the season. We just enjoy the plants. Now, do we have some weeding? Yes, there is. Oftentimes, the weeding for the first two seasons comes from the crown of the plant, because we got that weed seed free of charge when we bought it in that root ball. But even after that, something like a dandelion seed lands in the crown of a plant, it'll germinate. but it's so, so minimal. No fertilizer. We're not dividing them. It's kind of...
And your
kind
flowers,
of,
you're using...
We're a lot of native... native prairie plants, not all, but so in the far as grasses go, we're using prairie drop seed. We're using a little blue stem. We even for height, we can even use switchgrass, the pantagrass. I mentioned earlier the pale purple coneflower is a good one. A lot of the native asters, and some non-native plants like calamint is a great one, which has great drought tolerance. German status, which if we try to grow that in our typical soil, it rots off. We never get it to last. But in this gravel garden system, it's as happy as can be. If you come out to the garden, you'll see four different gravel gardens out there. The one that you'll hit right as you get out of your car is right there around the main entryway. Yep. This will be its third growing season now. So you'll see how quickly they develop. And again, the maintenance is so, so minimal. And that's the beauty of it. And I think it really has a place in our landscape. They look fantastic. Yeah. And you can arrange the plants any way you want. The style we have going is more of a naturalistic kind of a prairie style that we're going with. But if you want it to be more formal, you just design it that way, you know, with shorter plants up front, taller in the back, that sort of thing. You can color scheme them any way you want. If you want cool colors, hot colors, whatever. You know, and they just make so much sense. The one thing you have to do is create a edge or border. Now, in the one at the visitor center, we had a stone wall behind, and we had a sidewalk in the foreground. So, boom, or the foundation of the building on another side. So we were in good shape. The other gardens out near the herb garden and rose garden, we created a border with pavers or boulders, and we kind of mix it up to kind of. Create that barrier that has to retain the gravel right to the edge. If you just kind of taper the gravel off on the edge, that's where you'll get all your weed seeds. So if you maintain that border and the depth of gravel to 4 to 5 inches, you don't have that issue. So I can't say enough about that system. And between the gravel gardens and meadow gardens that we've been creating, we're really cutting down on the use of energy to maintain these systems, especially with the meadow plantings, using prairie drop seed, using some of the fescues that we only mow once or twice a season. And they're beautiful. And we add other herbaceous material into them and bulbs into them. Our meadow garden is just coming into bloom now. On the Facebook page, you'll see snowdrops and crocus that are just coming into bloom, and there will be wave after wave. There's literally 30,000 minor bulbs, the little flowering bulbs, through that meadow, and it is one of the most popular places to come during the season. And then by the beginning of the June, the bulbs' foliage is yellowed. We mow it, and then it's good the rest of the season. And you just have this nice emerald sort of hummocky look to it.
Yeah,
and it's gorgeous. My own front lawn is the same. Method much, much smaller, but you can use those things at home, and it's a little bit of a change over the formal look and the mowing every 7 to 10 days and all the other things you have to do to a lawn. But I'll tell you what, I love it. It's something different and has a little interest to it, and it's good for the environment. So, and it's easier for me, which is even better.
There you go. Oh man! Well, we've had a lot of questions online here. One that I might just take a crack at, and you jump in too. But somebody's a new gardener and looking for a recommendation for a gardening book. A vegetable gardening book for beginners, and there are some good ones out there. Melinda Myers has been a guest on the show for many times, and she's probably got 20 books out. And she has some really nice ones that work for beginners or for people who've been doing it for a long time. So I would just recommend taking a look at Melinda Myers' garden books. UW Extension at the UW Extension Learning Store online. If you go there, you're going to get all kinds of publications about vegetables, vegetable gardens, soil testing, all kinds of things, diseases, everything imaginable for Wisconsin, which is, and that's all free. You just go online and look at it. So that's
another.
It's
nice because it's so specific to our area, our situation, and they update them on a regular basis. So the newer disease-resistant varieties or, you know, and old heirloom, I mean, they do it all. It's a great resource.
We had another new flower gardener looking for some recommendations for a partly sunny area. What do you think about, that's so hard.
I'm sorry, what are they asking for?
Recommendations for some flowers for
You know, we were talking about sort of more environmental style gardening. A good friend of mine by the name of Roy Diblick has a second edition book called No Maintenance Gardening. And no meaning, or spelled K-N-O-W, because there's nothing in life that's no, N-O maintenance, right? And the whole premise of the book is to kind of get to know the plants that you're going to put in the garden, know your garden, and then design it in a way that it's minimal amount of maintenance, and plants are happy, the gardener's happy. And I would check that book out because it goes from everything of, you know, taking your little plot of land, how to deal with it. And then he has little plant palettes based on sort of a grid pattern, so you'll know exactly what to plant, how many, and then you can extrapolate that, you know, if it's, 20 square feet versus 10, it explains it all and gives you a nice list of different palettes or designs to choose from. And it's a great way to garden. And Northwind Perennial Farms near Lake Geneva or Burlington, Wisconsin has those exact plots that are in the book if you want to take a visit and see them. But it's a great resource.
It's called
The No Maintenance Gardening Approach, K-N-O-W Maintenance, Roy Diblick, D-I-B-L-I-K. And again, Google that, and I'm sure you'll find it.
And that should be available pretty easy to get a copy.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Get copies of that. Wow. Anything new in the way of plant? I mean, you're always looking at new things and maintaining, you know, kind of the great things that you've got over there. Some new ideas for this year or new plants?
Well, boy, there's always new plants. Never a lack of those. And we just had this discussion today with one of my horticulturists. I said, you know, I've been perusing the latest and greatest, and we can't even keep up with them all at the garden. And I said, does it really make sense because something's new to tear out something that isn't new, but it's working fine, to put something new in? And sometimes it makes sense, sometimes it doesn't. But you know, we're always adding new things, but we can't add every new shrub on the market. Proven winners, you know, as used to just be involved with annuals. Well, now they have proven winner shrubs, proven winner trees, and they crank them out. And I don't have enough space at the garden to put them all in. But we oftentimes visit other gardens, visit some trial gardens and such that will have every cultivar of panicle hydrangea that's come out, which I think there's five new ones this year, and look at them side by side, and then we pick the best ones, and then we put them in Olbrich. So we're always looking, we're always trying new things, we're keeping our eyes open, and then hopefully people see them, put the good use at Olbrich, and use them in their own gardens. Just because something's new doesn't necessarily mean it's better. And so we try to sort that out for people and then, you know, disseminate that information.
And again, the Spring Flower Show, it's on right now, and it goes to March 20th. People go to our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. You're going to see photos that Jeff's taken, and you just took those.
I took them this morning with my camera.
Yeah,
my phone, the camera on my cell phone, which does a pretty good job looking at those. But it gives you a great idea what the show's about, and hope it entices people to come out and see it.
Well, it's always a pleasure, Jeff. Thank you so much. I hope you'll come back and be with us again. We'll do this all over.
Anytime. Thanks for having me.
Jeff Epping is Director of Horticulture at Olbrich Botanical Gardens in Madison. If you haven't been to the gardens, You got to get over there. It's a wonderful place, and right now with the flower show on, it's a perfect time to get there and look at those flowers and that furniture. Beautiful, beautiful furniture that probably eventually a lot of it'll be up for sale as part of the show. So great to have him along, and again, thank you so much for listening. Just to look ahead again on Garden Talk, we'll be talking about next time about fruit trees and hazelnuts and high tunnels. So looking forward to that. And on Monday's show, we'll take a look at the timing of physical therapy and how it can help affect a good effect on surgery outcomes. In the meantime, thanks for listening.